Hey, today I'm on the Zoom to Australia with Shane Chaleo. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us, Shane.
No problem.
So you're a professional punter. You started in 2016. So how many years did you have to lose before you learned how to win?
It was about a 20-year apprenticeship of losing, I suppose. I suppose, like, realistically, always been involved in racing of some description, and basically the interest in was always just socially after playing football, and then, you know, go to the pub afterwards and catch the last race at Perth or something like that at Ascot, and a few bets with the, you know, with your teammates and that sort of thing before and after football. So there was always an interest in racing and wagering, but it did that. It did basically just a recreational punter for the majority of my adult life until about I took it seriously for 2 years while I was still working full time, you know, reading and learning and recording bets before I went full time. So, you know, realistically, it probably took me 2 years of recording my bets and, working full-time in a job outside of the wagering industry and watching races in my spare time and that sort of thing at nights and weekends and learning more about it before I went full-time. So.
Okay, so you weren't even working in the industry as such then?
No, not at all. Not at all, actually. I was in the agricultural machinery business for probably 10 years prior to going full-time. Full-time punter. So yeah, it was more or less a hobby, an interest, you know, in horse racing and racehorse ownership, and that got me onto the track, got me meeting people, that sort of thing, and that sort of piqued my interest, I suppose, and kept seeing these guys at the track and, you know, a few other professional punters that were always at the track, and it's like, there's got to be something in this, and that's basically what sparked my interest in it, really. I've always been analytical. So, you know, I was in like management and I was always looking for an angle within the numbers, you know, within the spreadsheets, within a profit and loss sheet. And I suppose when I got into when I was in racehorse ownership and then started going to the trials and then started looking at the horses that I was watching at the trials and that sort of thing. And then I was backing them. I was looking at what price I was taking, what price I was starting, started recording. And then the more I recorded and the more data I was able to capture from what I was doing, the more I was able to see that, you know, there's some opportunities in here. And then I really probably immersed myself in learning. Like I said earlier, I did that for a good 2 years before I went full time.
Okay, so you took the plunge.
Certainly no background at all in the wagering industry.
Right, so you took the plunge. You've been doing it now for 4 years. How many hours a day would you put into getting your bets?
Yeah, so things have changed. Actually, I was thinking about this today, knowing I was coming to speak with you. Pre-COVID, a lot of my activity was all around the weekend. So basically, I focus on one region, focus on Southeast Queensland. So it was Monday was just a pure review day from the weekend. As racing. Tuesday, I'd be attending barrier trials. So where I live in Southeast Queensland, these barrier trials they aren't. Televised or recorded or anything like that, so you've actually got to go to the track, you've got to write the brands down, write down who the trainer, who the jockey is, the, you know, whether they're wearing heavy shoes or race plates, write the gear down, take that. So that was so Monday review day, Tuesday trial day, Wednesday was you know, the metropolitan fields would come out, and there'd be a fields for say a Friday provincial meeting, so that was another full day there. So basically and then Thursdays again, getting fields coming up for the Saturday at the provincial meeting. So it was definitely it's a full time job, and yeah, there would be, I suppose, without sort of too much exaggeration, before a bet was placed, you'd be doing 50 hours, 60 hours a week on reviews and previews for the upcoming meetings.
Okay, so people in England would be the United Kingdom, I should say, would be interested in the trials because we don't have that. I mean, the trainers work their horses on their own private gallops. So tell us briefly how that works. And are the public allowed to go, or do you have to sneak in under the fence? And
so some racing jurisdictions in Australia have do record the trials, and they provide that information. We have official barrier trials, so all the information is there at official barrier trials. So they publish the fields, the times, and the results. We also have jump outs. So jump outs are almost non-official, if you like, but they're certainly not registered as in the form guide, like you would see some barrier trials here. So jump outs are basically an opportunity for horses to get past like their barrier certificate. They have to have a barrier certificate before they race. So trainers use these jump outs, which are more private, not televised, not recorded, not in form guides. So where I live, there would be approximately, say, 10 to 12 heats every Tuesday morning of somewhere between 6 and 8 horses in every heat. So, you know, roughly about 80 horses every Tuesday would have this private jump out. So the only information that we get is which trainer has a horse in which heat and the distance that the heat is conducted. So we'd have to get there and try and be a little bit strategic, I suppose, where we place ourselves and not try to make it too obvious to the trainers and other participants of what we're there for, but it's pretty obvious, obviously, you know, pretty obvious the reasons that we're there. So the first job you have to do is identify which jockey is riding which trainer's horse. And then to identify the horse, you need to write down the stud brand on one shoulder, and on the other shoulder is the, you know, is the brand of what drop it was and what year it is, so you can determine whether it's a 2 or 3 year old or 4 year old. And then you've got to try and get a look at the horse's shoes, because some trainers use heavy shoes, some trainers use race plates. So that would be, but the best way to describe that would be is whether you're running a 100 meter sprint wearing gum boots or track spikes, basically. So there's a big difference there, you know, in over 900 meter trial is a big difference. And then you've obviously got the race gear as well. You know, some horses you will trial with heavy shoes and no race gear at all, and you see them at the races first up from that spell or first race start, and the horse would have blinkers and a tongue tie, and then you have to go back through your sheets to see what if that horse wore that gear in the trial. So all those little things that you have to try and find out manually and do your homework. Like spending 8 to 10 hours on a trial day would be pretty consistent sort of time frame is what you look at to try and get the result, to get what horses which, then watch the trial, hand time them. A couple of guys sit up in the grandstand. We do a bit of work together. We sit up in the grandstand and we clock the horses and we hope that we get the times consistent over, you know, over a period of the day. And there's times where the clock doesn't work or that sort of thing that throws you completely out. But over the journey, that's where the biggest edge has been, I suppose, for me, is just to be able to see those horses, see what they do, and then I'm not sure what happens over there with you guys, but over here we have a lot of, in Queensland in particular, a lot of horses that have their first race start, and the form guides will say first starter unseen, no public trial, market's the best guide. So that's where we have, you know, some opportunities present themselves on the unraced horses, as well as those horses that maybe you've had 1 or 2 starts and for whatever reason, you know, maybe they were young horses and weren't ready, or shin sore or something like that, that have had 1 start, ran last, gone to the paddock, come back and has trialed well, you know, provides opportunities as well. But the trials is a big thing, all the jump outs, we call them up here. Certainly a big thing to have access to, that's for sure.
Now, imagine you guys aren't all that popular with some of the gambling trainers. So do they try and put you away, or do they try sort of hindering your work?
Yeah, look, we've seen, I'm not sure, we call it zinc cream over here, you know, the oil-based sort of sunblock, wiped over brands, so you can't see the brands. We've had certain trainers, you know, tape or bandage legs because... one of the ways you sort of try and identify a horse is by their markings, either on, you know, their heads or their legs. But sometimes you'll see, you know, trainers trial a horse with a hood on and, you know, some bandages, so you can't really tell whether that cannon's got some white on it or not, or whatever else. So a few ducks and drakes go on. It's But it is a little bit of us versus them mentality, trainers versus the punters at those jump outs for sure. Look, we just take the position that, you know, punters fund the industry. So we've got to get up there and get the info so we can continue to bet on these races.
And have you got any friendly insiders that might mark your card a bit as to who is what and what is on the day? Don't have to incriminate yourself.
Look, any information is valuable information. It all goes into the pot. You try and have your network and cast as wide a net as possible. Most of the time, the information will come forth after that person has had a bet. So, you know, obviously there's a fair bit of ducks and drakes going on to see everybody wants to get the top price. Very difficult to hide one nowadays, that's for sure. There's a lot more eyes. Everybody that's involved in a stable or something like that has got a horse going well. The information does spread pretty quickly. It's a pretty small community, the racing community.
I think. Right, Shane. Well, I was chuckling in between that because I'm sure there's a lot of trainers that love trying to put you guys away. One of the things that you said to me in your principles of what makes you successful is to know the horse. Now, can you go a bit more in depth as into what you mean by that? Know the horse. Obviously, knowing the horse on the trial is a good start, but from then on.
Yeah, I think it's just trying to understand some characteristics of the horse, which makes them a good horse or an average horse for whatever reason. So there's plenty of examples. I suppose where I sort of developed that more and more was, I suppose I started by Believe Your Eye was sort of my first thing. I'd like to, when I don't know how to articulate it any better than you like what you see. So I like the way this horse moves, or I like its action, or I like the way it pins its ears back when it's asked to surge, or conversely, when a jockey gets the horse off the bridle and asks it to quicken, it might put its neck to the side and want to lay in a little or lay out a little bit under pressure. And then I use the data to sort of back that up. Like if you see one that's just, I like the way it looks, I like the way it moved, but then you go back to the, then you go and cross-reference that against the data and the sectional times, and it doesn't quite, the sectional times or the data suggest that it didn't go as actually as good as what you thought it did. So I suppose that was an extension of that, is like understanding the horse. As you see, many a horse that could run a nice third in a metropolitan race, nice run, done the same things wrong, it wanted to lay in a little bit under pressure and the jockey couldn't straighten it and took a little bit of time to hit top speed. And then you see that horse drop back a grade, back to provincial grade, and it'll go off a short price favourite because it ran third in a metropolitan grade to start before. But you know that horse, and you know that when the jockey's going to ask this horse to quicken, it's going to put its neck on the side and want to lay in like it has for its entire career. And then you can sort of apply that to the, okay, so it's back to provincial grade. It's going to lay in under pressure at some stage. And this is a tight turning circuit back in the provincials in the country track. And by the time this horse gets around that corner, balances itself up and tries to make its run, it's going to be too far back. So I use that information of knowing the horse to, you know, take a position either against or for that horse based on all those factors of where it is. But, you know, there's a lot more sophisticated betting operations nowadays that use data. And so that's why I keep know your horse, my number one rule, is because I need to find something in that horse or see something in that horse that's not necessarily able to put a figure against or have one of those big betting syndicates that use purely data. I'm trying to look for something that they can't see in a number or a factor.
Right, you've anticipated one of my questions there, so I should go straight on to it. So you make a living backing horses based largely on what you see. So what do you see that other people don't see?
Well, I suppose we discussed in detail. I'm seeing my pool of horses that I bet into. I see them at the jump outs before they go to the race, so that's the first thing, I suppose. I go to track work, things like that. I suppose it's just plenty of examples. Even race day mood, there's plenty of examples of horses that play up. They get too hyped up in the yard, or they get too hyped up, they're going to the barriers, they want to charge to the barrier and then get behind the barrier, they're all worked up and they don't begin as well because they're all fizzy and all fired up, and they don't begin as well, or they over race. And then you can, because I see these horses most weeks, and you're watching them parade, and you might see it just, geez, he's relaxed today, this horse. He's his mind's on the job. He's there to race. So that's sort of the pre-race stuff. And you can see them on the way, when you're on course, you can see them, galloping away to the starting gates. You can see that the horse is relaxed and that sort of thing. And I do keep sort of notes on that sort of stuff, on the horses that stand out. But mainly I think the horse in the run, like I touched on before, there's plenty of examples of horses that, don't respond under pressure, or this certain horse doesn't corner well. But when he balances up and he's able to work through his gears in the straight, he can really flatten out and stretch out nicely. So he's not suited to a tighter turning track. And in Queensland, in the areas that I work in, we have such a diverse range of tracks. We have, Sunshine Coast, Eagle Farm, that race have metropolitan meetings where there's really big, long straights. Then you get to other places, say Doomben, another metropolitan track, for example, which mainly favours the on-speed runners, a little bit tighter corners, horses kicking out of those corners and hard to run past, shorter straights, harder to get momentum from the back, that sort of thing. Such a diverse sort of range of tracks. And, it's a cliche, horses for courses, but it's definitely a thing that I look at, that horses that are suited or unsuited because of that, just because of their racing patterns or racing manners in particular. The racing patterns are, they're well documented. It's easy to find. There's plenty of information out there in the marketplace where you can go to bet on a track and identify it's a leader's track and just back the leaders or the horses that are rails in run through speed maps and all those other things. But there's the things that I'm looking for is the sort of things that are hard to quantify, and that's those racing manners, I suppose. So, firstly, I'm seeing them at the trials and then at track work, and then, their racing manners, becomes a big thing. And you might see a horse that just didn't want to really take a gap or didn't really want to let down because it was sort of looking around. And then you see it next start, it has a set of winkers or, a set of blinkers on to which will sharpen its focus. And I'm sort of looking for those type of horses that have got some improvement in them with a change of gear, be it blinkers or winkers or something like that. So a bit of a long-winded answer, I suppose. But
No. So you say you see these horses. So do you go racing? Is that what you do? Do you actually go to the track to bet?
Yeah. So obviously the last 3 months in Australia, I haven't been able to attend a racetrack with COVID. It's been a lot more difficult. I'll go to the barrier, the jump outs / trials on a Tuesday, and then, track work either Friday and or Saturday. Those are the 2 days that they're more traditional, do their faster work. So I'm looking at that, and then to the track. Look, I'm not professing to be a yard watcher as such. I'm not really, focusing on the minute details of a parade ring, pre-race parade, but it's certainly a factor when you're just looking at them either parading or going to the gates, just looking at and noting certain horses and their characteristics and their behaviours.
Okay, now you mentioned that you specialise in racing Southeast Queensland. I assume that's because that's where you are, but and the pool of horses is about 600. Now, is that too small a number for you to get that much of an edge, or is it just a manageable number? Because I would imagine people over here would be thinking, well, that's not many. You'd soon get to know them inside out, and a lot of other people would as well.
Yeah, for sure. So where I live, there's a training centre, and there's about 600 horses registered at the training centre. So those 600 horses would run, about maybe three meetings a fortnight, I suppose. but they also go, you know, they also go and race, you know, like in, so I'm probably, our major metropolitan race meetings are in Brisbane, for example, and I'm probably about 130 kilometres west. So these horses that are trained here, they still go and race elsewhere within southeast Queensland. So I don't see, you know, the Brisbane trained horses and that sort of thing that they're competing against. And that's where I use my form analysis to try and stack up, you know, the horses that I follow here when they go to and race elsewhere. But I suppose a larger proportion of my business is done on the tracks around my hometown. So within like a, you know, 80 or 100 kilometre radius, there's five or six race tracks that these horses that are trained here will race. And that's where I do the majority of my business. And then, you know, the odd ones, you know, go into town or, you know, in the metro areas or something like that away from my immediate local area, but still happy to follow them down there and do the form. You know, okay. Based around there as well.
You say that you like to confirm what you see and you back up with data and sectionals. Now, is that, it's like, for example, sectionals, is that readily available or would you have to subscribe and do your own timings?
Yeah, so I subscribe to a program. So and that's able to give me, you know, it's a ratings program. It's also able to gives me some sectional time so I can look at, you know, sectional time performances on the day, just in raw figures, as in like the actual time itself. And then I'm also able to look at those sectionals in benchmark, as a benchmark rating. So I can look at, for example, if we're just looking at maiden horses, maiden class, I can compare maiden class to maiden class. And then once they win one race and step into a class one or benchmark race, I'm able to sort that by looking at that horse's performance against an overall benchmark, which is all horses, all class. So that helps differentiate a little bit, you know, when you're looking at these unraced horses coming through, and you're trying to measure an unraced horse, you only really have to measure that horse against other maiden horses. And then obviously once they win a race and then step into the class, or we have benchmark system over here, the program is also able to give you that data, you know, by comparing all class benchmark as well. So I do use both, but I do like to drill in a little bit deeper into some meetings and look at some raw sectional times as well. But mainly, it's a ratings database.
Okay, you don't have any. Any problem betting on maidens? I mean, the history of racing is littered with horses that went on to win the Derby but getting beaten first time out. Are the prices you get in sort of compensating for that greenness?
Yeah, it's tough. It's certainly not as easy as what it was when I first started. You know, obviously, you know, when you're first starting out, you know, you've got a few accounts with a few different bookmakers. You can sort of pick off a few odds on a Friday night for the races that are Saturday and take a really early position. You know, nowadays it's not as easy. You know, winning accounts are pretty well cut off to anything until the minimum bet law kicks in. So in Australia, the minimum bet law is at 9 a.m. on race day. Any bookmaker that, you know, puts their odds up has to bet you to win $1,000 as a minimum bet. So you know, a lot of business is done. You notice for anyone that sort of watches Australian racing and has a look at you know, some market fluctuations on Australian racing, there's a fair bit of action at 9 a.m. where, you know, most people are trying to get set for at least the minimum across the board, and then the sort of the day's wagering goes on from there. But you know, for these horses that are unseen, most bookmakers now are very cautious of certain stables in particular that are producing an unseen first starter. The odds are nowhere near as generous as what they once were, and getting on at the top odds is now, you know, well and truly a thing of the past. And it's most of the time you've just got to hope that no one else saw what you saw, and the price is still there race day. So it's becoming more difficult. I'm not saying it's becoming more difficult to get on. You do hear that a little bit in Australia, but, you know, it's hard to get on. I think what most people are referring to there, it's hard to get on at the top price that a bookmaker comes up with in the early odds. Most of the time, those prices are going up just to get a feel from the market and maybe one or two, you know, only takes one or two people to take those early odds, and that'll set the price off across the board. So a lot more difficult to see to get the top odds, but look, I suppose the quality of horses, if I'm being honest, the quality of horses that we have, you know, in this pool of horses in Southeast Queensland, I would say are lesser quality than what you'd find in a major metropolitan centres like Sydney and Melbourne, for example, over here, you know, the two major centres. The best bred horses, you know, go to Sydney and Melbourne, basically. And so a pretty even bunch, really, in Southeast Queensland. There's certainly no, I don't think there's going to be too many horses, if any, that are going to get beaten in a maiden first up and go on to win a Group 1. But just the way they train over here too, particularly in Queensland, there's a lot of prize money for two-year-olds and three-year-olds. So early, you know, they want to get their horses up and running early because that's where the breeding bonuses and those sorts of things attached to our prize money over here, it's all geared towards 2 and 3 year olds. So all the trainers, or majority of the trainers, want to get their horses up and running early, you know, punch a couple of good jump outs into them, get them up and running and go and win a maiden as a 2 and 3 year old that are worth, you know, good money, more so than win a four. So for an example, a 3 year old maiden with a Queensland breeders bonus would be worth say 30,000. A four-year-old maiden with, because the breeder's bonus cuts out at three. So a four-year-old maiden with no bonus is worth about 10,000 to the winner, like at a provincial track, you know, on a Friday afternoon, for example. So most of the trainers want to get their Queensland bred horses up and running early and try and win some of those bonuses. So not many are leaving much in the tank there early on in their preparations or early on in their careers. If a horse can gallop a bit, they certainly get them up and going. And
okay, Shane. So one of the things you said that people might find intriguing, winner finding is easier than finding the correct stake. Now, can you elaborate on that, please?
Yeah, I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to clarify that, because it sounds a little arrogant saying it's easy to find the winner. yeah, look, I suppose this is, it's been a process of trial and error for me, and part of my betting journey, I suppose, is thinking that I've found the winner, and then just basically saying, you know, finding the winner, less price sensitive. And you know, you read you could read 100 books, and you know logically in your own mind, you know, that finding value is key to long term success. There's plenty of there's plenty of races where you just look and you can see the obvious. It looks the favourite. And people back it because it's favourite and it looks the obvious, and not take into account of whether, you know, whether it's value or not. It's taken me a long time, well, it seems like a long time, to get that right. It's not sure that I've still got it right. I'm not sure that I'll ever get it perfect. I suppose I have a price, a rate, you know, I do my pricing across all the races that I want to bet into. And I'm basically now like, I know from my data that finding the winner is you know, you might have two or three picks in a race that you think can win, and you can nail that race down to two or three chances. And you know, the majority of time you'll find the winner out of those two or three. And then you have to have a look at your staking around that and look what you rated that horse and whether the price available was higher than your rated price. And I know from keeping my records is that you know, you do bleed money when you're backing horses that are shorter than what you think they are, and it just doesn't work long term. Littered with examples, but I suppose you just got to stick to your guns there on that side of it. And one of the biggest lessons that I had to learn, and it was very difficult, was happy to say that I think this thing can win. I think, you know, it's an even money chance based on the jockey's not the one I'd prefer to have on that's in the race, or there's another horse that's going all right. You know, it's a 50-50 chance of winning this race. It's even money. One of the hardest lessons was to let that horse go when I rated it even money. It started even money and was winning. I know, because I know that long term, if I price that horse an even money favourite, and and I want to take $2.20. I want to, you know, I want a little bit of margin in there. You know, happy to bet, and I work on a bit of a Kelly criterion sort of method for my staking. So one of the hardest lessons was letting a horse win without a horse that you like. You don't. It goes around the price that you rated it, and it wins. And be happy that you got that right. The market agreed with you. Your market was about the same price you were, and it won just like you thought it would. But there's no value in it on my pricing model. So if there's, it's very difficult. It was a difficult sort of lesson to learn, I suppose, is let that horse go around if it's not value. Continue to back the horses that are over my rated price that I think can win. And you know, the results just showed long term that that's where the money was. I do a little bit of repricing as well, something that I've probably introduced. Maybe 3 to 6 months I've been doing it for is repricing races after the event. You know, where you can, based on races that are run, how you think they'll be run, the speed maps and the settling positions are, you know, almost how you thought they would end up. And then repricing that race after the race. So this favourite, I marked it $2. It's led like I thought it would lead. It's actually won by 6 lengths. It really should have been $1.50 favourite. I really should have. It's won like $1.50 favourite. Reprice that horse, go back and look through the race to see if there's any other incidents or accidents that may have impeded other horses' performances on the day. And if they didn't, you know, you can confidently reprice that race and say, I had it $2, market had it $2.50, I've backed it, that's great, I've had X on it. But, you know, in hindsight, that really should have been $1.50 favourite. The market, I was wrong, the market got that wrong as well because it was still $2.50 on the day, you know, based on the Kelly criterion that I work on. For my staking, I should have almost had twice as much on. So things like that. So that's when I say, you know, finding the winners one thing, at staking the other. You know, a horse's starting price, the official starting price, is a form reference that I use, you know, when I'm doing the form for its next start. But I've, you know, like I say, about 3 to 6 months sort of introduced what the SP should have been or could have been based on the outcome of the event rather than what the SP was based on the thoughts prior. Starting to sort of introduce that a bit more to help with the staking. You know, I've seen it, so I've done it so many times of an average day or an average week, and you start taking prices on, you know, start taking $2 about horses that you price $2 and getting beat, and Murphy's Law sort of starts kicking in your head. The psychology starts getting to you a little bit there, that, you know, what can go wrong will go wrong when you start breaking your own rules. So, yeah, I hope that sort of clarifies a little bit what I meant, you know, with my statement about finding the winners one thing, but finding the value is, you know, is the key to winning long term.
Yeah, you've mentioned, I think you said, is it the Kelly criterion you've mentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah, so basically it's a bit of a staking. It's an I use an adaption of it for a staking method. So to help sort of work out an understanding of what my starting bank is, or what your betting bank is, what price is available, what price you rated the horse at, and then it works out a calculation of the value proposition there. So, you know, how much to have on a horse based on the value. You know, I've done one of the things that I did do was, you know, Google anything about Kelly criterion or anything like that. There's a plethora of information, you know, on various websites and books available and that sort of thing to talk about staking and value propositions and things like that. And the key takeaway for me is, like, I'm doing all this work, and I need to get paid for when I find the edge and taking advantage of that edge. So, you know, that's the work of going to the track work, going to trials, or doing, you know, 50 hours of form a week. One of the key things is to get paid when the value opportunity arises. So I certainly don't stake full Kelly as aggressive as that. I sort of use a variation that's a bit less aggressive. But basically, it's the bigger value proposition that you have is the bigger the stake. So, you know, I'm finding myself having more money on a horse that's, you know, going around at a 6-to-1 chance that I think's 2-to-1 than a horse that, you know, is of lesser value that I think is going to go around at 4 that I think's 3, for example. So So the bigger value opportunity that the market provides is where I try and take advantage with stake with my staking. So
I suppose the benefit of you being at the races, if something you make 2-1 is a 6-1 shot, you can look at the horse and be confident that there is no physical reason for that drift and be confident with your enhanced stakes.
Yeah, definitely. And look, I suppose, you know, market intelligence is certainly a key aspect of it. There is obviously factors, both, there is factors of why a horse is either supported or not in the market. If the horse is drifting in the market, I sort of look for reasons why. If there's no obvious reasons why, you definitely want to take advantage of that opportunity. And then the review process is, you know, whether it wins or loses, part of that review process is trying again to understand post race why that horse was that price. Was I wrong? Did I see something that wasn't there? Did the market see the obvious that I didn't pick up on, or was the market just completely missed that horse and I found something that the market didn't? The post race is, you know, I'm finding more and more the post race is as critical as the pre-race when it comes to assessing prices and races.
Okay, Shane. So moving on to other aspects of betting. You mentioned that you use automation. So is that bots or following a system, or what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so just once, you know, something I suppose, again, that's evolved over time, you know, in my punting journey, it's something reasonably new. Sort of found that you're so engaged pre-race on market activity. So I've got, I've got Betfair, I've got a third-party application where I'm looking at, you know, ladders to see where money's coming, where it's going, looking at another fixed a program that shows all the bookies and the fixed odds market so you can see where the money's been early. Use Betfair to see where it's going late, and I was finding that I was sort of so singly focused on a couple of horses, and I'd look and I'd say, oh, this horse has won at $12. I've marked it 10. It's drifted late. You know, I've missed some opportunity. So I started introducing a little bit of automation into my betting. So I'm able to look at any market, but obviously I focus on my own little patch. And I'm just putting in my rated prices. So with my automation, there's millions of different systems, I suppose, out there. So basically my automation is that I look at a race, there's horses that I want to back at certain prices or happy to back at certain prices, regardless of what the market's doing or whether, particularly on those horses that I've seen or I know or like, you know something of it from its trials or whatever else, and I think there might be some opportunities that the market won't like it late for no other reason than it's just a bit of an unknown quantity. So I sort of put those prices into the system, and with my automation I upload those prices on the horses I want to back, or conversely a horse that I want to lay if I think it's going to be shorter than an X price, the bot will lay it automatically, or if it's horse I want to back over a certain price, you know, the bot will back it automatically. And mine has a thing where the horse that I like in the race, if it wins, like I make it a chop out on my system. So that could be a horse that I've taken an early price on at 9 a.m. and it's going to start significantly shorter. So on Betfair with my automation, I just don't want to make that a losing result because I've got it going for a result, you know, on the fixed odds. So, and there's other races where I'm not too sure I want to bet in it, but if these horses meet this price late on Betfair, I want to take a position on them. And it does the business automatically. The money doesn't sit in the market. The bot just sits there and just picks those opportunities as they come up if someone's willing to lay a horse at that price. I found that to be a really successful way just to take positions on those horses at those prices that we spoke about that I feel are value propositions, because there's so much going on. And if particularly, you know, when you're back at the track and you're looking at mounting yards and all those sorts of different things, easy to click in and turn it off and, you know, not get caught. But at the same time, you know, there's so many opportunities that are missed because you're just so focused on, you know, there's other distractions as well at the track, you know, for whatever it may be. So automation is something where I can just plug my prices into horses with my price ratings, and then if an opportunity comes to take advantage of a price, you know, that's above my rated price plus a margin, the bot will do it automatically. And I touched on that earlier about looking at, you know, my results and, you know, seeing the good results, or the good margin with those horses winning were well above my rated price. That's where the margin is, obviously. So I just wanted to make sure that I was taking advantage of that, because I think I was just getting so grayed up and so frustrated when I'd see a horse win 50% above my rated price and I didn't have anything on it because it drifted late on Betfair because all the action was the favourite, which was the horse I was looking at, because that's the one I wanted to back at 220, and it was, you know, it was 220 and $1.90, and I'm, you know, looking at all different bookmakers trying to see where there's 210 available or, you know, whatever. You know, so that does, and it was just affecting my focus and I suppose a bit of mindset of, you know, just bringing some frustration into the game. So anything that I can do to try and get that frustration out of the game and those swings, you know, ebbs and flows of the emotion of the game is anything I can do to smooth that out. It's something, right, I'm going to put some time into.
That leads me nicely on, because there's not many professional punters that I've spoken to that I've included. They talk about losing runs and how they cope with it, but they've not actually mentioned mindfulness listen to you talk earlier there. You could hear the frustration that sometimes be going on, you know, your mind going 10 to the dozen because... So talk to us about mental well-being and mindfulness and how you cope with losing runs.
Yeah, so I think I made a decision a few years ago after a terrible run, is that if I lose my head, I'm going to lose all my money. It's as simple as that. You know, if I'm betting emotionally, I'm going to lose. And when I say betting emotionally, that could be, you know, chasing late in the day or late in the week or whatever it may be, or you know you're on a few day losing streak and you start chasing and I'm down, I don't know, let's just say I'm, this for an example, so I'm down 20,000 this week, yeah, you know, and it starts playing on your mind and you like this favorite, it's $2 and it's, you've rated at $2, but if I have 10,000 on this, I'm only losing 10 for the week, I can deal with that. All those sorts of things come into your head. Conversely, I'm unbeatable today. I've backed the first four winners. You know, this thing's a bit shorter than what I thought, but I think it's immoral anyway. I'm going to, you know, I'm winning a heap anyway. You know, bugger it, I'm just going to double my stake. You know, you lose your mind on the other side of the scale because the emotions are running high because you're winning. So, you know, I come to the realization that if I lose my head, I'm going to lose my bank, basically. And it's very easy to do. You're on course. You've had a few winners. Beers start getting purchased, shared around the place. It's very easy to get sucked in, you know, and lose your mind. So I basically come to the conclusion that, you know, what if I lose my head, I'm going to lose my bank. So, you know, I've got to invest in my mental health and well-being and start investing in me a little bit. So, you know, I've made the investments of time into doing form and, you know, attending the track and track work. I made the investment in databases, you know, hardware and software to, you know, to help me produce the results. I've got to start investing in myself. So, I spent a little bit of time and money in doing some work with some, you know, some coaches and things like that. So found some good value in working with business coaches. Not about business, even though, you know, treat my betting like a business, but it's more about the emotional side of business. And, you know, this business of betting is not too dissimilar to any other business, really. We make investments and they're either good ones or bad ones. And it's just with racing that we know our outcome of that certain investment within about 90 seconds. So the swings of the highs and lows of the emotions are more frequent than what they would be if you're in a traditional bricks and mortar business and business was sort of, you know, receding over a period of 6 months or growing over a period of 6 months, where with what we do, you know, we feel that emotion every 90 seconds of a race event. So, you know, I invested in a bit of that, done a lot of coaching to try and flatten the curve of emotion, I suppose, and just try and keep centered. Meditation, you know, and understanding the chemical side of the brain and the emotions and what triggers the highs and the lows, and just having and just, you know, working on an understanding of what the triggers are and how to identify the triggers before they, you know, sort of hit you emotionally. So, I've got a meditation app on my phone. I use that regularly. Take some time out, you know, in between races to try and, you know, calm down with breathing exercises, those sorts of things. It does get pretty lonely, you know, sort of I'm locked in my dungeon here at home and, you know, surrounded by computer screens, and it's very easy to get lost and lose time and track of where you are and what you're doing because you're so engrossed in the day, in the day's betting or whatever else. So just, you know, just those little things that I thought was well and truly worth of time and money to invest in understanding what causes these triggers. And then once you get a clear understanding, you know, I spoke to psychologists and things like that as well, something that I've done in the past to help, you know, reset and rebalance. Because it's, I think it's just like any other business really, you know, I'm only going to be as good as how I manage myself and my time and my emotions and the energy that I put into certain things. And I just want to make sure that I'm approaching every opportunity, every betting opportunity, I try to be as clear as possible and just trying to have a clear mind and make sure that I'm not making any decisions based on emotion. We've got all the data and all the information and everything at our fingertips to make a conscious decision based on that. But when it comes to staking, I found that could, you know, that's the part that you can manipulate a little bit based on emotion is your staking. You start to lose your confidence. You want to stake less. You're full of bravado and adrenaline because you're winning. You have a propensity to stake higher. So yeah, it's all about for me, it was just about investing in understanding the reactions and what triggers it. And then, like I say, a bit of meditation and that sort of thing. And reading and studying about mindfulness and that sort of stuff as well. Keep some clarity around what we're doing. So yeah, it's been very beneficial.
Just a couple of questions left. So first of all, you're talking, what sort of stakes are we talking what sort of level do you play at?
As in,
what would be an average sort of bet for you?
It would depend on the price of the horse. Like, you know, if you're betting to win 20,000 or something like that, it would be, if we're talking, you know, the right setup. So I like to talk about it that way as opposed to, you know, talk about it as like to win an amount rather than,
yeah,
you know, than staking you know, a certain level. But yeah, I'll probably work on three different levels. And some of it does come down to price, is price dependent based on what money you can get on and what time at what price. So the 9 o'clock price, you know, if a horse is $10 and the minimum bet laws kicked in at 9 o'clock and, you know, I want to back that horse because I've rated it lower, you know, I might have rated it $6 or something. You know, there's enough bookmakers around the place in Australia where you can have, you know, $100 across 6 or 8 different bookmakers. So straight away you can sort of get yourself set to win, you know, 6 or 8,000 there. And then obviously as that position changes throughout the day, the liquidity kicks in on Betfair as we get closer to the jump time. And then there's some decisions made from there on, you know, the market intelligence, you know, does have an impact on what I want to do. But there is horses and there, you know, I'm not sort of saying anything silly here, I don't think, when I talk about there is horses that when the opportunity arises and when the liquidity is there in Betfair and I can't see any reason whatsoever that this horse should have be drifting. It's, you know, it's one of those jump out horses or whatever else, you know, consistently I'm still happy to sort of keep betting away and regard depending on price. But we've had pre-COVID, the six months pre-COVID, there would have been at least 4 or 5 horses that have come through those jump outs where you're sort of betting to win that 50,000 mark on Betfair based on, you know, what you get on earlier in the day at certain prices. But the old thing about the bigger the price, the more you have on, I do work a little bit on that. I would much rather have $5,000 on a horse at $10 than $50,000 on a horse at even money.
Do you bet with the racecourse bookies?
Not locally. The bookie numbers are a sort of dwindling thing on course. And locally, the local bookmaker here, he does the jump outs with me on a Tuesday. So we're trying to find the same horses. So it's a bit of a gentleman's agreement that we're doing a bit of work together, and we probably shouldn't be betting against each other, because we're going to find ourselves wanting to be on the most of the time be on the same horses anyway. So look, and the game's changed a little, you know, a fair bit. The weight, you know, getting the money on has changed a little bit, you know, since I started. I found it easier earlier, and the longer I've been doing it, sort of the more difficult it has been. But there's ways and means around it. With the COVID thing in particular, there was the liquidity on Betfair was a hell of a lot stronger. I'm sure that the UK money was coming onto the Australian market because there's no races over there, and you know the liquidity here was enormous on, you know, on some meetings. So that gives you plenty of opportunity. You know, I'm certainly not the biggest or anything like that. I'm making an earn out of the game, and I can get enough on to make a good living out of it. And, so, you know, I still think there's plenty of opportunities in the market. You know, if you want to do the work to find those little edges.
Okay, so finally, a bit of advice back to those POMs you've been tucking up in that Australian race and they've been backing on blindly. What would be the best bit of advice you could give to a aspiring professional punter?
Best bit of advice I could give? I suppose the best advice I could give is probably the best experience I had, and I felt that the best thing is your network, I think. You know, one of the things that I'm fortunate to have over here is like a network of punters, I suppose, that you can talk to. Not necessarily about asking them how they do it, but I suppose there's an empathy almost, or, you know, almost like a brotherhood of you know, guys that do it professionally, and just, you know, not necessarily bouncing ideas off each other, but just, you know, the general conversation about, you know, all things racing, you know, whys, hows of, you know, different horses, different races or whatever else. Like I say, not necessarily chewing the fat, but I think it's important to have someone to talk to, because it can be very lonely. So I feel like, you know, a network is good, is a good thing to have. And that's just by reaching out and talking to people. Also, I think that there's plenty of opportunity out there. Like if you get, you know, Google any type of hundreds of podcasts, you know, series like this that you guys are doing, and just absorbing that information. It's not about, I don't listen to other punters or in podcasts and listen and watch shows to get secrets of how they do the form, but it's just their processes. You know, if you find a way to do the form or you understand racing or wagering, you can find an edge and an earn. That's great. That's one part of it, but being able to sustain it for a long period of time is really difficult because it can be so lonely. So, you know, my advice would be is to get a good network of people that you can talk to, and certainly reach out to, you know, to other peers in the industry, and, you know, do as much research as you can and listen to other people and read books about how other people have gone about it and their experiences. I listen to a lot of other punters that about their process more so than what they're exactly doing or how, but just like how their week looks, how their days look, how they do their reviews, their previews, all types of little things like that, which can make life easier. I keep coming back to it, but it can be a lonely game, and you know, it's good to feed the mind, do some, you know, understand how other people do it and that sort of thing. That would be, you know, a key thing that I would tell anyone to do for sure.
Well, brilliant, Shane. It's been very, very interesting talking to you. Thanks ever so much for giving your time up. And good luck in the future.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Cheers. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Follow our top sporting brand ambassadors, Davey Russell, Sylvester D'Souza, and Ryan Sidebottom, for their exclusive news, views, and tips on all the major events with blogs and vlogs at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.